Welcome to Educators to Educators. This is Carrie Conover, and you're listening to Season 2, Episode 3. Today, I am so excited you're joining us because I'm speaking with Lori Lamb, who is a first grade teacher at Fairbrook Elementary School in Beaver Creek, Ohio. Lori, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
Lori is a teacher I've known from many, many years ago when I was doing some professional development in Beaver Creek, Ohio, and she was just a standout teacher, and I knew I needed to get her on the podcast. And we were emailing back and forth trying to decide on what topic would be best to cover because, frankly, she's good at a lot of things. And we landed on the topic of project-based learning and museum learning. So we're really going to dig into that topic today. But before we do that, Lori, can you tell our audience a little bit about your teaching history and how you became a teacher?
Sure. I'm the daughter of two teachers. My dad was a high school teacher and my mom taught first grade. So I was always around school, sat around the kitchen table, heard all of the stories about school, so I knew what I was getting into. I started out in Ohio in kind of an inner city setting and have moved around a lot with my husband around the country for the past 21 or so years. And taught in a variety. I taught in, like I said, inner city. I taught in some urban classrooms, some parochial and private. I taught for 4 years and then was out for 11 years. And when I returned, I was in a gifted program and was itinerant in a gifted program in a suburban and rural setting. And then did Title I when I moved to another place and then went back into first grade and taught 1 year of second grade and year of third grade. And then I've been back in first grade for the past 6 years.
Well, that's why I think you are going to make such an incredible guest, is that you have really seen it all. And I know that sometimes we're talking about a topic and I worry that teachers are thinking, well, that's great if you're in a gifted classroom, or that's great if you're in, you know, suburbia, but that won't work in my classroom. And I think what I really like about having you as a guest is that you have been in so many different types of school districts and classrooms, and you know this can work really in any setting.
Carrie, I agree. And I think that's one of my core beliefs. I remember being in those gifted classrooms and thinking, this is for any kid, and every kid can learn this way. And in fact, I think I found in some of my students who, you know, struggle more with the typical school classroom subjects that they often are the ones who shine in the PBL subject area.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what we do here on E2E. So we always focus on three areas within our topic. So today we're going to be talking about project-based learning, and then we're going to focus on three areas. The first area is that PBL, or project-based learning, is engaging for the students, but it's also meeting the needs of a teacher needing to meet those standards with their students. The second area we're going to talk about is how student choice really, really drives engagement and creativity. And then the third area is talking about how giving students the opportunity to display their products in this museum setting, it nurtures creativity and really inspires them to work towards a goal. And of course, all of this develops 21st century skills. So let's get started talking about how PBL is engaging and really fun for students, but that teachers don't need to worry about, oh, am I meeting the standards? Am I going to, you know, cover all the standards I need to get to?
Sure. You know, there's a process you go through with designing a project for PBL, and you start off with a driving question that, you know, you look at your standards, you look at what you want to accomplish, your goals for your students, and you incorporate that into the driving question. And the driving question needs to be engaging and challenging and open-ended, which I think is sometimes what kind of trips some teachers up. It's like that open-endedness. You do have to have your goals and your standards, but I was amazed the first time I really went through this, knowing this was PBL, that, oh my gosh, we're talking about this. We're talking about phonics. Now we're talking about writing.
Like, you were checking the boxes in your mind, like, oh, we got that. We got that.
I was. Yeah. It was like, and they had no idea they were learning it, but they were also accessing knowledge they had through, like, phonics we had done or reading we had done. And so it really was a kind of a surprise to me how closely it linked to all of the learning goals that I was teaching in more direct teaching styles.
Well, and if you think about this, I mean, I think about my life working at a startup, working as a teacher, working as a professional developer. I mean, we're not just using like, okay, now I'm going to use my literacy skills. Now I'm going to use my phonics. I mean, it's all day, every day. Those things are all meshed together. Why wouldn't we teach our students like that?
Exactly.
So can you give me an example of an open-ended question that you've used in the past for project-based learning?
We did. I chose for this, there are several different types of PBL projects you can use. And the one I chose for this one was conducting an investigation. It was based on an historical event. So I started off, it was in the fall, and typically did, you know, history then and now or past and present. And so we focused it around the driving question that we used was, how would you live if you were a pilgrim on the Mayflower and moved to the New World? So I wanted to incorporate both the, you know, where they began in England and their travels and then life in the New World.
Great. That's interesting. Very interesting. So then what's the next step after you do that?
Then you have an entry event, you know, something, and it can be, if you are really doing museum learning, and I guess I should kind of back up and explain. I know we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but our district received a grant, which kind of pushed this to the forefront. So I had dabbled in project-based learning, but the museum learning part, the way the grant was written, and the concept of museum learning is that you interact with real museums. So I had previously not been doing that. You know, I had just been researching and using that, but or, you know, using resources that I had available to me. So for this PBL, though, I did this entry event, and it was a book I typically read to my class. It was called The Three Pilgrims by Cheryl Harness. But this time I decided, oh, we're going to act it out. So I was, I got a giant piece of blue butcher paper from down in the supply room and laid it on the floor for the ocean. And we talked about east and west. And that was my first, aha, uh-huh, oh my goodness, we'll make it in the east where England was. And so we talked about that. And as I read it, I broke them into characters beforehand. And then I stopped and we acted it out. And some of my colleagues always teased me because I would talk sometimes about the, you know, the hardships the pilgrims faced. So, you know, we had some people that didn't quite make it on the Mayflower and they were left in the ocean. But it was so real to them and they were engaged.
Yes. I have a first grader living in my home and I'm just like picturing her in your classroom. Absolutely loving that. And what I do like about that too, is it gets the whole class up and moving and involved, and excited. It's not like they're just sitting there. They're not just like taking in the information. They're already actively involved.
Yes, they definitely were. And I felt like from the beginning, that entry event that is engaging, it like right away launched them into that, driving question, you know, and that again, even during the reading aloud of that and the acting out, then we followed up with some, you know, questions and that curriculum content was there.
Yes.
I mean, they were asking questions about the key details. They were, you know, we looked at the illustrations closer and the photos and we read the captions. I mean, instead of having a poster or an anchor chart that says, this is a caption, this is a label, like we were digging into that book to find those things.
And do you find that, you know, you sometimes walk in teachers' classrooms and they have the day out to the minute, like first 10 minutes spelling, then vocabulary, then our reading block, then this and that. Did you find that you had mornings where you're like, we're just working on this Mayflower project for, you know, the whole morning, and you felt confident because you knew you were doing literacy and you were doing social studies and all of these different areas?
Carrie, absolutely. And I admit I was nervous because I was kind of, I just did that. I just knew in my gut that, you know, we're going to learn these things, and it was hard, but it's how I felt. And I think when I, you know, learned more about PBL and this museum learning, I thought, this is what's right for kids.
Yeah.
And I need to trust my gut.
Yeah.
That it doesn't have to be scripted and, you know, so mechanical all the time.
Yeah, I agree. I would like to be in your classroom as a student. Thank you. So after you do this opening activity, then do you move into more where you're like gathering information and how do you do that?
Yeah, so we did the opening activity and then brainstormed questions, you know, well, what more do you want to know? So typical, you know, brainstorming before you start a project. Then I brought in a bunch of resources. I, you know, obviously went to the library. I had books. We had photos. We looked online at photos of the primary resources we could. I used, because this was in November of first grade, so I don't have a lot of readers during then, so that was sort of one hurdle I looked at. It's like, how can I make, because I know first graders are capable of accessing these big concepts and understanding. And I always tell my kids, I always pull out maps because I love maps, and then they love maps by the end of the year. But anyways, I took links to websites, like I think most teachers know Scholastic has a great link to Plymouth Plantation and all kinds of video and audio to tell you about it. So I used QR codes for the links. So my kids, you know, I had a icon of family life or the Wampanoag village. And so they could take their, we have one-to-one devices, so they could, you know, scan with the QR code and it took them right to that website and they could listen to it. And so I tried to find as many avenues for them to gain the information.
I love that. And the great thing, you know, I think by my, you know, 8th, 9th, 10th year of teaching, what I realized is yes, and like gathering those resources and getting the QR codes together and all that, it is a lot of front loading for the teacher.
Yes.
But I, like, my stress melted away because I was doing all that work at the beginning. I wasn't trying to like backpedal at the end when I would get all these projects or the final test and kids weren't getting the information right. And then I was backpedaling, trying to reteach. It was like, I felt like a lot of the work shifted to the front, and then you have it year after year after year.
Exactly. That's what I found too. And same thing, like you mentioned about not, you know, spelling for 10 minutes, this for 15 minutes, but I also brought it in for, and it was about 2 weeks. I mean, yes, I taught math and other things. I didn't every day have a free for all, but, you know, I brought it into my reading groups and I used some online resources and things that, you know, the content was the same, but, you know, I had a lower level version for those students who needed it. And I had another, you know, so I brought that in what we were researching during our reading groups, which again, lent itself to all of those learning standards.
That's wonderful. So after they do this this research stage, can you talk a little bit about like, so then what happens after that research? And that really brings us into area two of like student choice. So after you kind of have that base level of knowledge, is that where student choice comes in for your students?
It did, yes. We looked back at our driving question and kind of broke it down, you know, started asking, went back through the story and looked at, well, you know, what was an important part here? And they kind of came up with the four categories on their own with me guiding them because, you know, you do want to meet those learning standards. So, after they had generated questions and, you know, used their background knowledge and we looked back through the story, we decided on four groups. Four groups were going to be Pilgrim Life in the New World, Wampanoag Life, Life on the Mayflower, and then the travel across and how they got from England. So they kind of, as a whole group, we narrowed down this question, and I think I actually cut them apart as we'd written those questions and said, well, all of these questions are about this. So it was sort of like doing an outline, like a brainstorm, yeah. And then we grouped them and they could see, oh, these all lend themselves to this, you know, topic and that categorizing that's so important for those early writers. So then what I did was we had our four groups and I posted them around the room in four different places and said, I want you to think about what you're interested in learning more about or what you, you know, think you know some about that you might want to do. And so I just let them freely choose, you know, if you want to work on the Mayflower, go here. So they went to each of the four spots and I think it was one of the groups was pretty large, and I knew it could, I needed them to be divided evenly. So I said, let's take a look at these groups. So again, this was like every single step of this process was problem solving. And it wasn't me saying, oh, we have too many kids in this group. It was, well, let's look at our groups. Is it going to be easy to work in this group, or are we going to have too many people and not enough jobs? And so I said, if some of you have a second choice that you might be interested in, and Carrie, I'm not kidding you, it was so easy. There were no tears. It was a couple of them said, oh, I'll go over here. And they really self-selected where they wanted to be. And I looked, and I will admit, a couple of the groups, I thought, oh boy, you know, but I didn't put them in there. They weren't maybe all differentiated as much as you would want them to be, you know, like, but it was, I just, again, trusted it. I thought, we're just going to try this. It has to be about student choice, which helps drive that engagement.
So once the students have gone into their groups, how do they decide what their product is going to be for the project-based learning?
Well, I sat down with each group in like a reading group format and said, you know, what do you think based on your research is important to let people know, or to, you know, tell people most and answer our driving question? So each of the groups kind of came up with a list, and I use like an organizer, a T-chart kind of thing that's a topic and then details down the side. So we went ahead and made one as a group. I was the recorder for them. So one group decided that they were going to show how the pilgrims actually traveled from England over to the United States. And they came up, and again, this was over about probably 2 days of meeting with them in a small group. You know, they came up with some initial ideas. Then I sent the group off by themselves to, well, what could you do for this? Look at what your details are and your information that you collected in your notes. And, you know, what do you need to include? So they came up with the idea. They were going to have a big blue ocean with paper on the floor, and then they drew outlines of America and England. They made a small-scale ship, and then they had they decided they were going to write like a paragraph on note cards. So again, kind of linking to that museum product display, you know, quality museum products, so that their labels needed to explain clearly. So that was their idea. The ship builders, we discussed scale, and we talked about, do you want it to be able to sit on a desk or a table and draw pictures and have, you know, a small 3D model, or do you want a big one? Well, they said big. I brought moving boxes, and they designed, dry fit it, and, you know, looked at details of a ship, the sketch of the ship and the pictures that we had, and figured out how to put it together. And so that was their idea. And they also labeled the names of the shipmen, the sailors that were on the ship, what their jobs would be. And they labeled the masts and the sails. And I mean, you could walk around this thing, and their final thing, this was the part that brought out, I remember one of my students, very quiet and had a, you know, learning wasn't always super duper easy with reading. And he was the one who really came up with, how are we going to make this sail be able to, because it was made out of paper, you know, look like a sail and stand up. And so we had these masts made, and they figured out how to get the mast. I mean, it was a total engineering project with the ship. So they figured out how to get the mast sticking straight up. And then someone said, we could tape the sails to the mast and hang it from the ceiling. So there was this giant sail hanging from the ceiling. And I will tell you, the look on their faces the next day when they came in, when they come up with the idea, but I hung it after school. When they came in the next morning, they were so excited.
Aww.
So, yeah.
I love to hear that engagement.
Yes, the pilgrims decided on a large-scale pilgrim house made out of like a refrigerator box, and then the Wampanoags went a different route. They did more of a kind of a museum, like if you would walk into a room that was just about the Wampanoags, and you would see a full-life, the art teacher, we collaborated with her, and she drew an outline of a full-size Squanto, and they dressed Squanto with, you know, his beads and his clothing and that. And then there was a model of a Weetoo that, and they had engineering again, how to build that. And then I'll talk about this a little bit later when they talked about their display, but they also showed about planting corn.
So we're going to move into talking about that third area where you have this museum and the students are able to display their learning. But what would you say to the teacher that's like, well, I need grades. Like, how do you grade this work? How do you assess the students?
That is a good question. I think that is something I am still probably working on. I started off with this having like a note-taking sheet for every student. Again, it was November of first grade, and not all of them were capable of that. But a lot of it was observation. It was anecdotal notes. It was me, you know, when I met with the group, okay, what is your part in this? What have you learned about this? So, you know, it's not, oh, you have 8 out of 10, so you have an 80% on how you build right. your Mayflower. Yeah. You know, so it's, you have to be a little more open-ended with that, using rubrics. And we did have a rubric. The rubric I used, I just started with one rubric, and we talked about working in a group. And so I did have that, you know, black and white, if you will, of a checklist of yes, you did this, no, you didn't do this. So
let's talk about the final stage and the displays and how you present the final product.
Yes. Going back to the grant is where the museum part comes up. You know, PBL, you can do with anything. The part of our grant that was the museum learning, and our administrators had a chance to go visit a school that is a museum learning school in Tennessee. And I couldn't wait to start. So I had done this whole project before we had actually been trained in it, because I just was so excited about it. So, and I actually called the school in Tennessee to see if I could talk to their project lead. And so I talked to her and picked her brain a bunch. But the museum part is where you actually have artifacts, displays, labels, museum quality things that are on display. Now, our museum, my students and I had talked about how we wanted to display it at the very beginning, and we talked about what a living history museum was, and they really wanted to do that. So this was more of that, they were docents. And so part of the requirement with our grant is that we do have a museum display. So the way I chose to do it for this, because we weren't officially into the grant yet, was that we presented to a second grade class, came down, and the students were all in their locations, and they were the docents that led the student groups through it. And then I had parents were invited, parents and relatives and that. So they came in. But I found that them acting as docents, it's one way to do it, just like you can go visit any kind of a museum. But the docent part of that for my first graders was so engaging and so just fulfilling for them. And the confidence that I saw in them that day was beyond measure.
Well, and I wanted, for anyone out there who doesn't know what a docent is, could you maybe explain what role a docent plays at a museum?
Yes, a docent is someone who goes around and leads you through the museum and talks about the display. Sometimes I think I'm right about this, it can be someone dressed up in period garb, you know, during that time period. But a docent basically, you know, will go around and take visitors and explain each of the parts. And I think my favorite part of the docents, I can't say the favorite part, but one of the things that really stood out, the Wampanoag group had decided to do this interactive. They were really adamant about showing how the Wampanoag had helped the Pilgrims, because we talked about, you know, the issues that ensued after the Pilgrims came, but they wanted to show how the Wampanoag had helped. So they said, we want to show how they planted corn. So they came up with the idea they were going to make a how-to, and they hung it from the ceiling, big posters in step 1, 2, 3, 4, how the Wampanoag showed them how to dig and plant the corn and put a dead fish in it, so for fertilizer. So they wanted it to be, they first said they wanted to plant corn and show people how they would plant the corn. And so we talked, that then led to science and the growing season, and we only had a week, would that really be able to show it? So I said, what other way could we do that? And one of them, they sat and thought for a while. I gave them that time to think. And one of them said, Well, my mom makes this thing and she grinds up Oreos and it looks like dirt. And the minute he said it, I thought, oh my gosh, that recipe for dirt cake that people used to make a lot. So I said, oh, well, you could do that. And I said, well, then what would you use for the corn? It was fall, of course. So they came up with candy corn and they could not get the fish. And I tried every way. So I said, well, it sounds like they could eat most of this. So what else could you do? And I said, is there any kind of candy? No. So we got our iPads out and I said, well, let's, you know, what are we looking for? Fish, and we want something to eat. So food, and it popped up Swedish fish.
Oh,
so
perfect.
They had this interactive where the classrooms that came, they got to show them this is how they made it. They put the dirt. And so that goes back to that product choice, that student choice. I mean, theirs was not just, oh, let's make a candy dish. It was what they really wanted to show, how the Wampanoag, how they wanted to represent the Wampanoag.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, so I have two kids and I have a fourth grader and a first grader. Mm-hmm. And my son and his friends, you know, I carpool them all around to all their different sports. Mm-hmm. And last week and the week before, they were working on this economy project. And they were talking about like goods and services, and they were doing a whole unit, and each kid had to come up with a good and a service, and they had money that they were going to earn. I mean, these boys, fourth grade boys, would not stop talking about this classroom economy.
Yeah.
And it was funny because even my son, I was trying to like nudge him with some ideas. I really try to stay out of his homework and let him do his own thing. But I was like, oh, you know, and he's going through our junk drawers looking for things he can sell in his like store. But my point is, they were so excited about this project. And let me tell you, it's not often that the boys, 10-year-old boys in the carpool back of my car are talking about school projects. And I have to imagine that your students are super excited talking to their parents, talking to their siblings, grandparents about what's going on in your classroom.
I think they are, you know, and I'm always amazed at if you use the language and you set the bar high, they're able to learn that. And they really are.
So Lori, as we wrap up, I have a question for you. Could you ever go back to like the way we grew up learning, which was mostly textbook and sit in rows?
You know, I don't think I can ever let this leave my teacher toolbox. It's something, you know, I learned this way, and I've seen the value for my students and the memories it makes for them and the deep learning that it gives them. I know it's hard. I hear it from people, you know, about, oh, well, the demands of high-stakes testing and all of that. And I know there's research with PBL and Museum, you know, that students who participate in good PBL projects score higher than students who are taught by more standard, or that they score no less than. So I think there are wonderful things about this, and no, I don't think I could not sustain it, you know, week after week after week after week, but I definitely think, you know, two times a year for two major projects like this to ingrain my students in just the processes and those 21st century skills, definitely. I don't see how I can go back to it.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, and I talk to a lot of new teachers all the time who are like, there's just so much to get done. And I say, pick for project-based learning, do one in the fall and one in the spring.
Yes.
And then the next year, you're going to find more things, you're going to get better at it, and then maybe you add a third. And then you add your first, you know, media, creating media in the classroom. And every year you just sprinkle in a little bit more. You're not going to be able to do it all at once, but I do believe the work is really the first time you do it, is getting everything together and all the resources. And then, boom, you're just improving it year to year. Would you agree?
Yes, I definitely agree. I do. And I think you can still have that basic driving question, those basic goals, and every project every year is going to look different because your kids, through their product choice and the student choice, they're going to come up with a different project based on the same standards.
Yeah. Well, Lori, I have just really loved having you on the podcast. I was mesmerized. There were moments that you were talking that then I realized it was time for me to talk, and I was so caught up in what you were saying. So that's a sign of a really good podcast. Lori, you are an E2E insider, I noticed, and it's something that I've been talking a lot to the people that listen to these podcasts about becoming an E2E insider. I work with a lot of companies who want to do focus groups with teachers. Working with a company right now, we're planning focus groups for teachers. You literally log on from your computer, you participate in a focus group for an hour, and you get $25. I mean, and you get to hear your voice heard. So I encourage all of you listening out there, become an E2E insider. And Lori, thank you so, so much for being here today and sharing your talents with us.
Carrie, thank you. And thank you for doing what you're doing to give teachers a voice.
You're so welcome. Before we close out today's episode, I want to make sure you know how to get a hold of me. You can follow me on Instagram at educators2educators. Make sure that's all one word with the number two. You can find me on Twitter at ccinchicago. And finally, visit my website at www.conoverinnovativeconsulting.com. Conover spelled C-O-N-O-V-E-R. Visit my website to find out how to become an E2E insider, free webinars, and just stay connected to the work we're doing at Conover Innovative Consulting. And until next time, keep on teaching on.